because otherwise the U.S. would be attacked.
So for over a year now in Washington, you would hear over and over again this Israeli talking point that Iran is very weak, that it's the weakest it's ever been, and that this is the right time to now strike it. And so eventually we got to a point, as in this weekend, in which those strikes happened. And it, you know, we're only in day five of the war now, and I think part of what we're seeing is that the Israelis and the Americans have underestimated Iran's capabilities to strike back hard against the region. Iran is up against the biggest military superpower in world history, and the only nuclear-armed state in the Middle East. So, in military terms, yes, it is not as powerful as those countries. However, it has sort of defined and declared and developed its defense doctrine over all of these decades to be asymmetrical warfare against these kinds of forces in the region. And so what we're going to see play out, Iran is not going to surrender. Iran is going to continue to fight this and to inflict as much damage, not just on Israel, but importantly on the American security architecture in the Gulf region.
At the White House Tuesday, a reporter asked President Trump about the worst-case scenario in Iran. This is what he said.
Well, I don't know if there's a worst case. We have them very much beaten militarily from the military standpoint. They're still lobbing some missiles. At some point, they won't even be able to do that because we're hitting all of their carriers. We're hitting all of their missile stock. You know, they built up all these missiles over the last few years. They had a lot of them. They've shot a lot of them. And we're knocking out a lot. I guess the worst case would be we do this and then somebody takes over who's as bad as the previous person, right? That could happen. We don't want that to happen. It would probably be the worst. You go through this and then in 5 years you realize you put somebody in who is no better. So we'd like to see somebody in there that's going to bring it back for the people, and we'll see what happens with the people. You know, they have their chance, and we've said don't do it yet. If you're going to go out and protest, don't do it yet. It's very dangerous out there. A lot of bombs are being dropped. But I always say that would be about the worst.
Professor Bajoogli, your response.
The way that Iran is responding to all of these strikes right now is by it knows that the U.S. has critical low amounts of interceptors in the region, and it's playing the long game. The Americans do not want a long-term war and a war of attrition, and Iran is absorbing the hits and is going for a long-term war of attrition. And this is something that both the Americans, the Israelis, and those in the region have to sort of consider.
And the CIA arming Kurds?
Yeah, the CIA, there's
Where
reporting.
Where do the Kurds live? Right through to Iraq.
Right through to Iraq and also on the border with Turkey. If the CIA does this and the Kurds come in and sort of foment an internal uprising, we're going to see this really continue. And then Turkey will probably be giving a lot of intel to the Iranians on this because this is not in Turkish national interest either. This is the danger of this moment. This has already turned into a regional conflagration, and this could turn into a regional war of a scale that will make the past 25 years of forever wars in the Middle East seem like a walk in the park.
Narges Bajoogli, I want to thank you for being with us, Associate Professor of Anthropology and Middle East Studies at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, co-author of How Sanctions Work, Iran and the Impact of Economic Warfare, also author of Iran Reframed, Anxieties of Power in the Islamic Republic. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's also escalating its bombardment of Lebanon, where officials said today at least another 11 people were killed in Israeli strike on a hotel in a Beirut suburb and a residential complex in eastern Lebanon. Israel also announced a wave of attacks across southern Lebanon. Lebanese authorities told Al Jazeera an estimated 65,000 people have been displaced in Lebanon due to Israel's attacks. This comes as Iran continues to launch retaliatory retaliatory strikes at U.S. and Israeli targets across the region, including the U.S. Embassy and CIA station in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, the U.S. consulate grounds in Dubai, and the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East. Turkey said today a ballistic missile fired from Iran had entered its airspace but was destroyed by NATO defense systems. It's unclear whether the missile was targeting Turkey. In the UAE, debris from a drone intercepted by defense forces sparked a fire at an oil terminal. Meanwhile, Qatari authorities reportedly arrested 10 suspected members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps, including several accused of being assigned to spy on vital and military facilities in Qatar. That's according to Al Jazeera. For more, we go to Doha, where we're joined by Marwan Bashara, Al Jazeera's senior political analyst, as we talk about this widening escalation. Can you respond, Marwan Bashara, to what has taken place over this last 5 days?
Well, clearly, since the assassination of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, it seems that Iran plans for the war were put on an autopilot of sort. This is not a justification. This is simply a potential explanation as to why Tehran is lashing out the way it is, with many of its leaders and commentators that I've heard the past 5 days are incapable of explaining what exactly is Iran doing, because the claim is that they are attacking American bases and American installations. But in fact, Iranian rockets and missiles and drones have hit various economic and residential installations in various parts of the Gulf. Of course, there's also been attacks on Erbil in northern Iraq, on Jordan, and other places. So the only plausible explanation for now is either there's been a decision been made that if Iran is going to fall, everyone else is going to fall, or there's a predetermined decision that says there has to be a cost to be paid for American interests, for the West and the various stakeholders in energy and economy and so on and so forth, so that the higher the price, the quicker there will be pressure on the United States to end the war.
Talk about this latest news in Turkey. Talk about how an attack on a NATO member could pull more countries into the fighting, and Turkey's position on the U.S.-Israeli strike on Iran.
You know, for the time being, what is quite astounding is the decision by, at least here, the Gulf countries not to respond, not to join the American-Israeli onslaught against Iran. They've been taking, of course, a lot of defensive measures, and I would expect Turkey to do the same. None of them want to join an Israeli war of choice, a hegemonic war on the part of the United States, Israel against Iran, not only because most of them don't think it was right and they stood against it, they condemned it, but also because this will even widen further the regionalization of the war, as we've seen it the past 5 days, but basically put on steroid. So the fact that this could actually go out of control, and the fact that there are those who are interested in this regionalization, notably the Israeli government, Netanyahu and others, who actually foresaw this happening and wanted this to happen. They wanted the chaos within Iran. They wanted the chaos within the region, because they're the only ones capable of affecting, influencing American decision-making for the time being. And they think the worse it gets out there for Turkey, for the Gulf region, for Iran, and so on and so forth, the better it is for Israel.
I want to go to the Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal. They were just briefed yesterday in the Senate.
I just want to say I am more fearful than ever after this briefing that we may be putting boots on the ground.
boots on the ground, Marwan Bashara. If you can comment on this and NBC reporting the U.S. torpedoing of an Iranian naval ship in the Indian Ocean off the coast of Sri Lanka. It's the first time a submarine has sunk a ship since World War II.
Yeah, it's interesting to read various assessments of this sort of a thing happening in the likes of The Economist, right, the British Economist, or the Wall Street Journal, where the stupidity, the fallacy, the failure of this administration in copying not one page, not two pages, not a chapter, but the entire playbook of the Bush administration. I mean, they've repeated every single false pretext that the Bush administration carried or diffused in order to justify the war against Iraq in 2003. We've known what a disaster that war was, not only for Iraq, not only for the hundreds of thousands who died in that war, but for the thousands of Americans who died and for the trillions of dollars that were spent in the first 10 years of the war. So we see the Trump administration that called that the stupid war and called that the forever war, now repeating exactly the same, walking in the footsteps of the Bush administration, except this country, Iran, is four or five times the size of Iran. The Iranian regime is far more coalesced and far more united than the Iraqi regime was. And clearly this threatens to be a far worse in a war and its implication for American long-term security and for the stability in the region than the Iraq war. And yet, here we have this American president, Israeli prime minister, who promised to become historical figures, tragic historical figures of sort, who have learned nothing from the lessons of history. And this is just fresh in the mind, right? Only 20 plus years ago when the United States got stuck. But it wasn't just Iraq. I mean, after launching a 20-year war in Afghanistan for regime change, after launching a war for regime change in Libya, what happened in Iraq, Libya, and Afghanistan the past 20 years? They all turned into costly fiascos. And yet here we have another administration. It's like the American government, as if Washington is addicted to, international violence, to wars, to assassinations, to launching those hegemonic wars that they could not end, that they always tend to end in fiascos. And you know what, Amy, not just the past 20 years. I mean, the Korean War, for God's sake, haven't even ended. What, 70 years later? The Vietnam War, what happened with that, right? So America gets involved in all these wars in the Gulf, in Southeast Asia and elsewhere. None of them are successful. They all tend to fail since Second World War. And yet, the capacity of American governments to be repeating the same mistakes again and again, launching hegemonic wars, forever wars that fail, that are costly, that cost America its reputation, that cost its credibility, its soldiers, and its tax dollars. Here we are again.
Marwan, I wanted to ask you about the role of Saudi Arabia. The Washington Post reporting Trump launched Saturday's attack on Iran, quote, after a weeks-long lobbying effort by an unusual pair of U.S. allies in the Middle East, Israel and Saudi Arabia. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has publicly supported a diplomatic solution, also said Saudi airspace and territory can't be used for an attack on Iran. However, according to the Post, made multiple private phone calls to Trump over the past month advocating a U.S. attack on Iran. What does Saudi Arabia have to gain from this?
Well, the thing is, right, is that we've heard exactly the opposite scenario being expressed by Saudi commentators on Al Jazeera, amongst others, saying that the crown prince, sent his defense minister, his brother, to Iran, who met personally with the supreme leader, the late supreme leader, to tell them that Saudi Arabia has zero interest in a confrontation with Iran, and it agrees with Iran on the question of Israel. So, go figure. But there's one thing for sure, back to your question, is that Saudi Arabia has no interest in such a confrontation, such an Israeli-American war against Iran. There's one thing we've learned in this region, is that when the type of, Iran and the United States or the Soviet Union and the United States or who, or whoever, it's along that Swahili proverb, right? When the elephants fight, the grass gets crushed. When elephants play, the grass gets crushed. So whether there is a rapprochement between Iran and the United States or whether there's a war between Iran and the United States, the neighbors tend to pay the price. And there's clearly there is no interest for any of the neighbors for this kind of war to be launched this way on false pretext, on a total hegemony, not planned well, clearly with no end in sight, and with no real objectives, right? The way this is happening and the way this is being rolled out, this promises to be an utter disaster for all involved, including Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states, and many of the neighboring Arab states.
Marwan Bashar, I want to thank you for being with us. Al Jazeera senior political analyst speaking to us from Doha, Qatar. When we come back, the acclaimed Brazilian filmmaker Kleber Mendonça Filho on the Oscar-nominated film, The Secret Agents. Stay with us. Wartime by Farrell Foster. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to look at one of the most celebrated international films of the year, The Secret Agent, directed by the Brazilian filmmaker Kleber Mendonça Filho. The film has been nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor. The film is set in 1977 Brazil during the final years of the military dictatorship and stars Wagner Moura as Marcelo, a technology expert who's on the run hoping to reunite with his son in Recife during Carnival. But the city is not the nonviolent haven he seeks. NPR film critic John Powers says of the film, quote, "This small, brutal, often funny thriller uses the travails of one of ordinary men to capture a reactionary era in its daily realities and surreal absurdities. Its public cruelty and private decency." Director Kleber Mendonça Filho wrote the screenplay during the presidency of the far-right president Jair Bolsonaro. This is the film's trailer.
You really think you should be here?
I'm taking my son.
It's foul play at the highest level.
You have to be there very early on Friday morning.
Is that Armando?
No, his name is Marcelo.
Armando. If I was you, I'd get the hell out of here. We need to protect what we still have, you and my grandson.
You have no idea who you're messing with, boy.
To a better Brazil with less mischief.
This man.
I'd kill him with a hammer.
Do you carry a gun?
No, but I know how to use a hammer.
That's the trailer for The Secret Agent. It won Best Director and Best Actor. Wagner Moura at the 2025 Cannes Film Festival. I interviewed the film's acclaimed writer and director, Kleber Mendonça Filho, this week and started by asking him how he came up with the idea for this film.
Well, the idea came together, as it often does, from different angles. First of all, I wanted to do a film with Wagner. So to make a film with an actor, you better sit down and write a script. The second thing, I was coming from Pictures of Ghosts, my previous film, which is an essay film. And that film gave me a lot of information on Recife, my city, on on film going in the 20th century. And it just put me in the mood to write a story which would take me back to the past. On top of that, I wanted to write a thriller set in the 70s. And as I was writing, I began to realize that a lot of what was happening in Brazil during the Bolsonaro years was in fact creeping in and being part of the logic of what I was writing, because what those people did, Bolsonaro and his inner circle, it really felt like they were trying to bring back the good old days of the military regime in the 60s and 70s. And once I understood that, I think the film strengthened its own inner logic. But it's only something that I realized much later in the process. And today I can talk to you very openly about this, but it's something that I came to understand quite slowly. So when you write, when you make a film, when you think about what you're doing, sometimes you capture a certain frequency which is in the air. And I think The Secret Agent is very much about the past, but it's very much about the past repeating itself through amnesia. You know?
For people who aren't familiar with Brazil's history, with this reprise, perhaps, echoes of the past with Bolsonaro's presidency, go back to the 1960s. Talk about what happened for 20 years up until the mid-80s.
Well, in 1964, there was a military coup, March 1964, and that military regime went on to rule Brazil in the 60s, in the 70s, in the late 70s and early 80s. It began to crumble, and it just crumbled out of being completely rotten. 1985 is when we began to think about general elections, democratic elections. And it was a violent period. It had support by the U.S. at the time, because, of course, it was a division between East and West. I think the U.S. and many in Brazil feared that Brazil would fall into the hands of communism. So that's one of the reasons that the coup d'etat took place in 1964. And anyone who questioned or just disagreed with what was going on was either persecuted or tortured or went into exile. And the film takes place in 77, which is towards the end of the decadence of that military regime, but where the democratic forces, they were still very much intimidated. And that's exactly what they tried to bring back in 2017 with the democratic election of Jair Bolsonaro.
Introduce us to the hairy leg.
The hairy leg is a wonderful urban legend. And the urban legend of the hairy leg was developed by two journalists, one of them called Raimundo Carreiro. He worked in a newspaper in Recife, Diário de Pernambuco, which is featured in the film. And he came up with the hairy leg as a way, a deterrent to deal with censorship. He could not write about what actually happened involving the security forces, the police, the military police, because they were very violent against the people. So instead of having his articles censored and slashed, he came up with the hairy leg, and he began to print straight stories where the incidents would be described in a journalistic fashion. But instead of saying that the military forces did it, he said that the hairy leg did it. And it would come with cartoons and drawings of this zombie disembodied leg attacking people. And it became a cultural and popular phenomenon because, of course, the radio picked it up and did radio plays with the hairy leg. And little kids, I remember as a little kid in the 70s being terrified of the hairy leg. And I think it's a fascinating development of a dictatorship. It reminded me a little bit of how the Czech press had to deal with, the Soviet invasion using the media, but not really being open about what they were, just using suggestion. And for many years, I wanted to use it in a film, and it finally happened. I think it's a great scene in the film, which gets quite a lot of reactions. You know,
let's go to the hairy leg in The Secret Agent.
A local man named Pedro Jorge do Nascimento, 27, a student living in the Mostardinha district, was out on an evening walk in 13 de Maio Park with a friend by the name Alexandrino Borges, 32, a dental prosthetist living at Bombo do Emitério, when they were caught by surprise by a shadow that came hopping out of nowhere and started kicking them. But this is so odd.
Odd, but we all know what that is, don't we?
It's treated as news in the paper.
Teresa, read the bit about the attack. It's great. Read it.
But you've read it.
But it sounds so much better in your Angolan accent.
Thank you.
Another clip from The Secret Agent, the 4 times Oscar-nominated film. This is also focusing on a newspaper that they're reading.
Yeah, there is this idea in the film. It's not something that I planned. I just realized once I was rereading the script, and then I embraced that idea. Everything you see in the newspapers in this film is either imprecise, wrong, or just fantasy or lies. And it doesn't only come from the fact that we are dealing with the dictatorship when the newspapers were used to make the dictatorship work morally, let's say. But it also comes from my own experience working in a newsroom in the 90s. I was a journalist and professional journalist. And I saw many decisions going on in the newsroom which had to deal with someone's maybe losing money if something is going to come out, or maybe we should not name that person, or maybe we should give it another word to make it sound less harsh. And this is something that, coming out of journalism school, it was quite a learning experience, because of course in journalism school you learn what the world should be, and in the newsroom you understand what it has to be, you know.
As we're talking now, the U.S. and Israel have just bombed Iran. Iran has retaliated, attacking other Gulf countries. You wake up on Saturday morning. This is the time leading up to the Oscars, but it's more than that. It's a time when a film like this about a dictatorship is getting global attention. And what were your thoughts?
I can't help thinking that history is a cycle of repetitions. I'm 57 years old now, and in over the years I have seen so many hyper-violent, brutal developments that have to do with aggression, just violence and land grabs.
Brazilian filmmaker Kleber Mendonça Filho, the director and screenwriter of The Secret Agent. The film's been nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Actor. The film stars Wagner Moura. To see the full interview, go to democracynow.org. That does it for today's show. On Saturday, March 7th, I'll be in Savannah, Georgia at the Hindsight Film Festival for a screening of the award-winning documentary Steal This Story, Please, about the 30 years of Democracy Now! It begins at 7. 7, check our website at democracynow.org. I'll be speaking at the Q&A after with the film's director, Tia Lesson. That does it again for the show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's Nardwar, the human serviette, saying you're listening to CJSF Burnaby and do-do-loo-do CJSF. Yeah.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more. Radio.